Interview with Kamlesh Jayantila, Purohit. The date is the 11th of February 2004. Okay, like I just went through a bit earlier, I'd like to start off the interview with some of your family's background. And more to the point, could you tell me where your parents were born exactly? Do you know the names of the towns and cities that they were born in?
Well, my parents were both born in India, in Gujarat. My dad was born in a small town.
Okay, yes, it's recording.
Good.
Okay, can we just backtrack and start off again with where your parents are from, please? Thanks.
Yeah, my parents are both from India. Both my parents were born in Gujarat. My dad was born in a town called Nar, and my mom was born in a place called Boriabi, both smallish towns in Gujarat. My dad emigrated, I believe it was in the 1950s, emigrated to East Africa, mm-hmm. and later was joined by my mum and a couple of my brothers who were born in India. Then I was born in East Africa, in Nairobi, in Kenya.
Okay. Why did your father decide to move to East Africa?
I think it was an economic move, really. Mm. I think it was always seen as kind of a way of perhaps developing in terms of economics, you know, trying to find a better job and then bring the kids across, mm-hmm. provide a better sort of educational sort of climate for them. Mm-hmm. So that was, I think, the move. And at the time, with the British developing the railways there and that sort of thing, there was a lot of opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I think it was really just an opportunity that my dad saw.
Okay, and what was his profession at the time then?
He went across at a very young age. I think he was a student, mm-hmm. in those days, and he joined my grandfather, who also emigrated across there as well. But he then later educated himself as an accountant.
Okay.
And worked there as an accountant, mm-hmm. and he was actually working as an accountant when my mum kind of went across and joined him.
So they were married before he...
That's right, before he actually went across, yeah, yeah.
And did your mum or dad ever tell you about the journey over or anything like that?
No, because, I mean, I was very young. My father passed away just before we moved to England,
mm-hmm.
so I have very few memories of my dad. My mum often talks about the difficulties that she had, I suppose, being away from her husband. So while she was living with her in-laws in Gujarat, you know, she obviously was very young at that age, and she was looking forward to the time when she could go across to Africa and to join my dad. So I think, you know, she certainly sort of talked about that anxious kind of period, you know, just waiting for a time when my dad sort of had, I suppose, steadied himself in terms of getting a decent job and a steady income so he could support the family.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that sort of a period. I think she was obviously very pleased when she was finally able to go across and start a new life in Africa. I think it was kind of, you know, seen as, you know, moving to a country where you were going to get better opportunities. So it was a very exciting period for her, I suspect.
And so where were you born then?
I was born in Nairobi in Kenya,
okay.
in 1961, so in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was born in Nairobi, and I was about, I think, 10 when we moved to England,
mm-hmm.
in the 70s. I have a few memories of Africa.
Yeah,
all of them are very fond.
Yeah.
I think it was a very exciting time, a very exciting sort of place to be for a youngster. I think the difference we noticed, certainly I noticed as a youngster when I came to England, was that life was very kind of, I suppose, constrained and very formulaic once we moved to England. I think we certainly felt a lot more freedom in Africa. You know, there were places to go and things to do, opportunities, you know, that you didn't really have here. By that I mean things like, you know, being able to play in open areas. There was obviously a big contrast, you know, in Nairobi, which was a very sort of modern city, you know, modern in that context. But then, of course, you know, if you moved out of Nairobi, you had some stunning national parks and beautiful wildlife and you know, and all that sort of thing. when I moved to England, to Leicester, it was very different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the life was much more set, I think, you know, in the way, you know, we sort of lived here.
Did you have brothers and sisters when you were in Africa then?
Yes, I'm one of four brothers.
Okay.
So I had three other brothers, and I was the baby of the family. So so it was kind of, I don't know whether that was a good thing or a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways it was good, because, you know, I had bigger brothers to look after me and tell me things and that. But then at the other end of the scale, you know, I always sort of ended up with stuff they didn't want, the toys they didn't want and stuff. So I suppose, you know, there were pluses and minuses.
Mm-hmm.
But we were a very close family unit. It was always brought up to be, to kind of, I suppose, be very caring. You know, I feel very grateful for the way my parents brought us. We were all Hindus, brought up in a very Hindu sort of way. We were, you know, taught to practice religiously, both by going to the temple as well as practicing at home as well. And the fact that I lost my dad at a very young age, we all lost a very important member of our family, and that really brought us together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we appreciated things at a younger age that other people may not have done, because of the fact that we went through this very difficult period. And I think it sort of made our faith much stronger as
mm-hmm.
well. We didn't have any other relatives. We had no sort of close friends to rely on. And I suppose we only had ourselves and our faith and our religion
mm-hmm.
to turn to.
And did you start school in Africa then?
Yes, I was at school, primary school,
mm-hmm.
in Africa. And then, of course, continued my education when I came to England,
mm-hmm.
Which wasn't a problem for me because... excuse me. Because we were in Kenya, where the medium was English,
mm-hmm.
we were taught in English. The culture was very British anyway, because it was a British colony. So for me, when I moved across to England, that wasn't a problem. The transition was quite smooth, really.
And why then did your mum decide to come to England?
Well, my family was moving to England anyway.
Yeah.
Again, for economic reasons, you know, I suppose... When you were in India, you know, moving to Africa was seen as a way of bettering yourself. And then when my family finally settled in Africa, after a couple of decades, clearly, you know, to kind of move to England for education and a better sort of environment where you could bring your family up was seen as as the way forward.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a British citizen because my grandfather acquired British citizenship by moving to Africa to work on the railways. So, you know, it was... you know, it was just a question of applying for the visas, and once the visas were granted, you know, we were going to move across. It was just very tragic for us that literally weeks before we were moving, my dad was killed in a car crash. But we were moving across anyway, so my mom decided to continue with that process, and we moved to England because she thought that would be the best alternative,
mm-hmm.
which is a very brave thing to do for a woman in her 30s with four young kids, the youngest of whom was... something like 11, and the oldest was about 15, 16.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very brave thing to do, to move to a country where, you know, you had hardly any friends, totally strange environment, different culture. But she really felt in her heart that this is really the way that she would really kind of, I suppose, do the best for her family. The temptation would have been to go back to India, where she had all the support and family and
mm-hmm.
stuff. But I think she looked at the future of her children more than herself, which is a fantastically brave
mm-hmm.
thing to do.
Absolutely. Can you actually remember the day that you left, the actual
yes.
journey and the arrival?
I do.
Tell me
I
about
do.
It.
It's one of those things that will be etched in your memory, and it's never going to go, because it was such an exciting time. I mean, obviously the sadness was we'd just lost our father, so you know we were moving to this new country and this new challenge, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Without a very important member of the family. So there was obviously that sadness there, which we felt, particularly when we left Africa, because that was really kind of the last contact we would have had with him, you know, in that, yes, this is where we'd spend so much time with him. So there was that sadness there, obviously. But we were also very excited at moving, you know, to a country like England. You know, all the things that you'd seen in the films and in the calendars, you know, the things like kind of streets covered with snow and all that sort of thing was what I was expecting when I was going to come to this country. So we were all, as kids, were very, very excited. And I do remember that I went to see some of the friends, some of my school friends, to say goodbye the day before we kind of flew out. So that was quite sad, you know, because you almost kind of realise that you'd never see these friends again. But that was, I suppose, made up by the fact that we were really excited at the fact that we were coming to England. You know, the journey to the airport and getting on the plane was so exciting. You know, for a child, you can imagine, 10, 11-year-old who was getting on an aeroplane for the first time. It was very exciting. And then the journey itself, I don't remember much of because it was in the night, and I kind of remember I more or less slept through the whole night. But occasionally, so you wake up and look out and all you see was clouds and stuff. So there was not much else to really kind of remember the journey by. But when we arrived in England, you know, suddenly you just everything was so different. You know, just the airport, very modern, much cleaner to what you were used to. A lot of white faces, which you weren't obviously you wouldn't have seen back in Africa and stuff. So suddenly you realise that you're in a different country. But the first thing that hit me, and I still remember that, was when we stepped out of the plane. The instant we stepped out of the plane, and the cold wind hit our faces. And straight away you knew that you weren't in Africa anymore and that you were in another country. It was cold, even though it was actually, I think, spring when we arrived. It was in March we arrived. But still, it kind of felt like, yes, you were in a country with a different climate, the cold, the wind. But the sun was shining, you know, and I think that was kind of the first thing that I remember.
Yeah. What year was it then that you came?
That was in 1972, we arrived in this country. And it kind of feels just like yesterday, really. I mean, I've been in this country for over 30 years now, but it doesn't actually feel like 30 years. You know, a lot of these memories, when I think back to my childhood in Africa and my early days here in England, they just seem like a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. And who came to collect you then at the airport? Was it Heathrow Airport?
It was at Heathrow Airport we arrived, that's right. And my mum had a friend, a childhood friend, who was actually born in the same village as her. Went to the same school, and they were like sisters, and they used to be in Nairobi as well. And ironically enough, when I was born, I was a premature baby, and my mum had to spend time in hospital, and this lady who, you know, was my aunt for all intents and purposes, she was like family, looked after me, so she was almost my second mother. So when when we arrived in this country, and she was there to collect us, bought this kind of 1940s or 50s Bedford van, you know, cluttered old thing, you know, to kind of pick us up. We didn't have much luggage with us, obviously, as you can imagine, but, you know, just our clothes and a few bits and bobs. So saw her, and she was as I remembered her, even though I'd not seen her for, I think it was like 10, 12 years. She was as I remembered her, you know, before she left and that. And in the photographs and things. And getting into the van was quite exciting, and then I don't think we actually came along the motorway. I'm not even sure if, you know, people actually drove on motorways in those days, but certainly, you know, I remember going through lots of towns and villages before we sort of arrived in England, and it was wonderful to see these buildings, which are so different to the buildings that we, you know, sort of grown up with in Africa.
Yeah. Do you want to get my water?
Yes, if
yeah.
you don't mind.
Okay,
sorry.
Okay, so how did England compare then to what your initial thoughts are? You know, before you came here, you know, you had this great idea of what it was going to be, and then what was it actually? How did that compare then? You know,
sure.
The streets and the villages,
yeah.
And you know, you'd had thoughts on everything.
Well, the thing is, you know, for us, going to England was like arriving in heaven. You know, we'd built that up so much in our minds that we just couldn't fail but love this place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, for me, it was actually my new home. You know, we'd sort of moved to this place. We were so excited at coming to England that it was our new home. It wasn't like, oh, this is a place we're going to stay in. It wasn't like that. It was actually, even at that stage, a place where, you know, we were going to be there for the rest of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And when we arrived here, of course, you'd heard stories about what it would be like. Then you see it yourself, you know, the beautifully clean streets and very structured kind of lifestyle. You know, there wasn't chaos on the roads and everything was very systematic. It was a wonderful place to arrive to, you know, and you knew because you'd heard so many things about England, about education and about the health system and everything, that you knew that this was the place to be.
Mm-hmm. Where did you then set up home when you first arrived in Leicester?
Well, when we first arrived, we were fortunate enough, as I say, because of my aunt and my mum's friend, who was absolutely, her and her family were absolutely fantastic, looked after us, and we stayed with them for a few weeks while we settled down, and we found some rented accommodation again in Leicester, because, I mean, that was the only place where we had friends, and so it was quite natural that we settled in Leicester. Not a big Indian community in those days, but still, you know, enough faces around to kind of make you feel, yes, you know, you're not alone here.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't a problem, you know, it wasn't a big issue really, to be honest, at that stage. You know, I don't think we quite realised some of the problems that we'd start to face a little later on. At that stage, everything was very kind of, you know, everything was through rose-tinted glasses. You know, it was just the worst, the best place you could have come to. So, you know, we sort of got a rented place where we began to settle down. Obviously, the first thing was to sort out the schooling for us, and my eldest brother, who, if you like, had to start becoming the breadwinner. So, from being a little boy of 16, he had suddenly to become the breadwinner of the family. My mum was beginning to learn English. She was then doing some work at home. She was doing some sort of sewing, you know, some piece work at home, for which she would get paid, which gave her the best kind of scenario, because she could stay at home and look after the family, but at the same time earn some money for the family. But it was really tough on my brother. I mean, there was no doubt about it, because here he was, you know, he was a schoolboy in Africa, learning, you know, and studying to go on to do a degree. Suddenly was told that he couldn't continue with his education anymore, because he had to now become the breadwinner. And I remember the first job he got was at a bakery in Leicester, and he came home crying his eyes out, because he had to lift bags of flour, which he just couldn't. I think the bags of flour were heavier than him. And he had very little sympathy from, you know, the sort of environment where he worked. People weren't very sympathetic with him, and it was very, that was a very upsetting time for us, actually, because I think it dawned upon us that, you know, things were going to be tough, you know, for us, because, you know, we had no natural breadwinner at the house, but he had to find a job. Luckily, he did find himself another job where he was much more comfortable, working for the GPO, I think, the General Post Office that it was in those days, you know, doing some wiring work for telephone exchange stuff and that. And that was much more of a kind of but still, you know, for someone of his calibre, it was very tough, because he was obviously, you know, very ambitious about, you know, progressing in his studies, but he had to kind of, if you like, sacrifice that for the family. For the rest of us, it was just a case of, you know, going to school and college and progressing with our education. And my brother was there to kind of support us through that.
What was it like for you starting school then? Because how old are you, 11?
I was now, yes, just turning 11
so
now.
So did you go to secondary school?
I was in the fourth year of a junior school.
Okay.
Just 1 year before I went to secondary school. And to be honest, it was absolutely fantastic. I really couldn't complain about the way I was treated there. I suppose in some ways I was a novelty. I was the first Asian to go to that junior school, and the headmaster was absolutely fabulous. All the white kids in my class couldn't have been more supportive. They were very, very friendly, almost kind of took me under their wings, and you know, would take me to the playground and tell me what was what and where to go, and you know, which classes to go to and stuff, and they were great. And I think what was really good from my point of view was, because I'd arrived from Africa, I could speak English quite fluently, and I integrated quite well into the structure. But I was able to bring a lot of different experiences to the classroom, and I think that went down really well. I remember, you know, being asked to stand in front of the classroom to talk about wildlife in Africa, or life in Africa, Indian cooking, stuff like that. And I think I was seen as, it was very positive. There was, you know, no element of kind of racism in that at all. People were very positive. I think it's later on, when later on in that year, when suddenly we had this influx of Ugandan Asians who were expelled in 72. So later on in that year, that the climate began to change, and I think people became much more aware, if you like, of ethnic minorities, of Asians in particular. And the climate then did change decidedly, and there was a lot of racism and a lot of racist attacks. But that sort of happened when I moved into my second school, which was in the secondary school. But my experiences in the junior school were extremely positive and actually a really good introduction to educational life in this country.
Which school was that? Is it still around?
Rolleston Junior,
mm-hmm.
In Wigston in Leicester.
Okay.
To be honest, I've never been back there. I'd love to go back there again, but I have never been there. I don't even know if the school is still
mm-hmm.
there. But it'd be fantastic to be able to go back there and relate some of my experiences that I had
mm-hmm.
as the first Asian in that school.
Mm-hmm.
And of course then we were joined by lots of other Asian kids. Because I was one of the more senior members, if you like, because there were younger Asian kids coming to that school later on that year, a lot of whom couldn't speak English, so I was then taken by the headmaster to kind of almost act as an interpreter
mm-hmm.
and stuff. And I think that kind of meant I had gained a lot of respect amongst the teachers and the headmaster as well, because that's extremely helpful and
mm-hmm.
stuff. We were brought up, what did actually strike me, and this still remains in my mind, was the way teachers were treated. Because I was brought up, like I say, in a very to be very respectful. And my mum always used to say, and she used to recite this thing in Gujarati, which translated means, treat your teachers like your gurus. So almost like your parents. Your teachers are your gurus. And so I had a lot of respect. So even in their absence, for example, my class tutor was called Mr. Fishburne, so it was always Mr. Fishburne even in his absence, whereas the other kids called him Fishface, so it was Fishy or Fishface. And I found that quite amazing, because I wouldn't even dream of being disrespectful even in their absence, because they were my gurus
mm-hmm.
and yet the other kids would call them, you know, stuff like that. So that was quite a culture shock for me, which kind of, if you look back now, it makes you laugh
mm-hmm.
it's quite funny but because it was, you know, culturally something I wasn't used to. Even, you know, when the other kids that were in Africa as kids, you know, people were very respectful of their teachers. So that was quite funny when I kind of noticed how, you know, people used to make faces behind teachers' backs and stuff. I found that quite shocking, actually.
You said that when you moved to your secondary school, then there was like a change in atmosphere with the
yeah.
influx of people from Uganda as well. Did you ever experience firsthand then some of this racism or these
very, very
arose.
Much so. Very much so. It was actually not a very pleasant time, to be honest, because it was now the early 70s. There was this influx of Ugandan Asians. I think there was a bit of a backlash from the local community here. What didn't help, though I didn't realise this till a lot later, was the Leicester Mercury publishing this article saying, "Don't come here, we don't want you." And I think that was kind of very typical of the climate that was created for people here. It was difficult because Asians are very placid, not very militant. I think we weren't here to take people's jobs or anything like that. We were here because we wanted to contribute to the society. But it was difficult because you weren't made feel welcome. Sadly for me, my school was in an area which is actually still renowned for being very rough, the Northfields Estate. So the school I went to, Mandela Boys, was a school where the local environment wasn't very conducive. If you're Asian, skinheads were very prominent in those days. I think paki bashing was a bit of an art. You know, people made a pastime of paki bashing, which meant, of course, that not only in your own school you had people who were overtly racist, but you had people in your own class who were overtly racist, and being called oi pak was quite normal. You know, which wasn't a problem. I mean, that names didn't hurt, but it was when it resorted to physical violence that was quite disturbing. Running the gauntlet every day at 3:45, you dreaded the home time because, you know, you needed to get away quite quickly because you'd have gangs of skinheads waiting for you. So it was quite a tough period in those days, especially because of the area where I lived. You know, there were lots of skinheads and there was a lot of racism there. It got markedly better once I got into the third and the fourth year. A, because I was older then,
mm-hmm.
and so I suppose, you know, when you're smaller, people can pick on you because, you know, they can bully you. But secondly, I think, you know, the atmosphere began to change, though not markedly, but it was improving.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, people began to realise the contributions that the Asian community had started to make here, and the hard-working nature of people here was beginning to be appreciated. So I think things were beginning to change, but certainly the first 3 years were quite bad. And, you know, to be to have your head kicked in the school playground wasn't uncommon. What made it more difficult was that the school really didn't understand the problem. Teachers and head teacher didn't really understand this problem of racism. And I remember one day I was actually beaten up really badly by one of my own classmates, and sobbing away, you know, as a little child, you know, sobbing away because I just felt so sorry for myself. And I was then told by my class tutor to stop being so silly and to pull myself together. It was that kind of environment, so people weren't very sympathetic. You know, people weren't very sympathetic to bullying anyway. But racist bullying, people just weren't even really, to be honest, aware.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem for me was the fact that as a Hindu, I was brought up as a vegetarian. And school dinners were a real problem because you were never served vegetarian food. And so I would always have mashed potato and cheese every day or salad, you know. So it was not very exciting to have that for 5 years, as you can imagine, is what I used to always call rabbit food. And I remember one particular incident where I was served the cheese with the same utensil that was used to serve the meat. And because I was so small and quite young and it was difficult to express that to the person who was serving the food. And I said, no, I don't want that now, I want this, because of the fact that the utensil had been used, which was also used in the meat dish. And she thought I was actually being silly and messing her about, and I was taken to the headmaster, and I got sort of severely told off. But as a child, it was very difficult, because you see, in those days, people didn't really understand what vegetarianism was, but also what the Hindu philosophy was when it comes to eating meat and stuff. And it was difficult for us to explain. Now the things, the understanding is much greater. People understand, you know, this thing very, very much easier now. And also the sort of food which is served in schools is much more culturally sensitive now and religiously sensitive. Of course, it wasn't so in the 70s. So, you know, that wasn't very pleasant, you know, eating sort of rabbit
mashed
food.
Mashed potatoes for
5 years, you know, which is probably why I look the way I do.
So then you left school and I presume you went to college or university?
Yes. So I went to college. I did my A-levels.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that became very evident in the school was that despite all the adversity, and majority of these of the Asian kids in my school were Ugandan Asians or Asians who'd come from East Africa. So they were extremely educated, spoke English very well, and were highly motivated because of the fact that the parents were very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
Education was, and still is as we know, but certainly in those days was kind of seen as the way to progress. Because we'd arrived in a new climate, and really the way to move yourself better, to better yourself, was to get a good education. That was the first and foremost thing on people. Yeah, do you want to, yeah, we'll start up again, yeah. No problem, don't worry. Rolling again, yeah. Yeah, so basically it was, education was kind of seen as the way to progress, you know, and to get better jobs and stuff. So there's a lot of emphasis put on education, and not so much on sport and stuff, which is why we probably see the legacy of that now, in that Asians are very successful in lots of sort of areas of education and academia, but not so in terms of sport and stuff. I think that's changing now. But in those days, the emphasis was different. So it was always expected that I would go on to college and to university, you know, which is what my brother had done. My brother older than me, and my other brother was also, you know, going to college and stuff. So it was always expected. It wasn't ever going to be any other way. I wasn't going to leave college school to go to find a job and stuff. So that thought never occurred to me. It was always a case of, okay, well, once I've got my O-levels, which A-level shall I do? Because I've got which degree am I going to do? So it was always kind of just plotting your future in that way. And so what we noticed was, academically, the Asian kids performed very, very well indeed. You know, the top two classes were kind of more or less dominated with Asians, you know. So then went up to education. I went to college, Alderman Newton's, which was a sixth form college. Formerly a grammar school, then became a sixth form college. I had a fantastic time there. Really, I think probably one of the best periods of my life. Made some fantastic friends who I still kind of keep in touch with. But I actually felt like an adult for the first time in my life, and we were treated like adults. We had our own common room. The problems that I faced in terms of racism back in my secondary school was couldn't have been more different here. You know, people integrated, white kids and Asian kids, and everybody just mingled. People were more mature. I think that the problems that we were facing in the sort of like the middle and early 70s of racism were certainly kind of things of the past now, and people were, you know, beginning to integrate into society a lot more. And I really enjoyed myself, and I think that kind of reflected in the sort of the results I got in my subjects. I then went on, did my A levels, and like many Asian kids in those days, I did the sciences, maths, physics, and chemistry, and I then went on to university to do electronic engineering.
Can I ask, how did you end up in radio?
It's a long story, actually. Well, it's not a long story. It's, I always had a passion. Radio was something that really excited me, because while I was growing up, see, things are very different now. You have Asian cinemas, Asian restaurants, culture clubs, temples. In the 70s, it was very different. There was very little for you to do away from, you know, your school and perhaps a bit of local activity and that sort of thing. But radio played a very important life. Leicester was quite lucky in that. Leicester became one of the first stations in the, or one of the first cities in the country to have Asian programming on the local radio station. So we all grew up. I suppose that was the kind of link, if you like, with the rest of the Asian community in Leicester. And, you know, if somebody had a birthday, you'd know about it, because it was just one program and everybody wrote to that program. It was quite common for the program to get 500-600 requests, you know, per program. It became a very focal point in the community, so we all grew up listening to the radio a lot, and I loved music anyway. And so when I grew up, it was kind of something I'd love to have done, you know. I'd love to kind of present my own program and things. I never ever thought it would become a career for me, because my career developed as an electronic engineer. I started to work in a company called GEC in Leicester, designing control systems for power stations. But at that stage, I also then got involved with some freelance work with Radio Leicester. So it was just a hobby for me, really. I was just kind of making coffee, answering phones. And it was really funny, because I didn't realise that people I grew up listening to idolising would become colleagues and friends later in my life, because I just loved radio so much, and I used to listen to the radio a lot, and had lots of ideas about how I thought, you know, they could better programmes. And so I wrote to the station, and because they were looking for new blood, and I wrote to the station. I didn't hear anything for months, and I just thought, well, you know, no chance. And out of the blue, I got a request to say, well, come down, we'd like to chat to you. So I came down to Radio Leicester and spoke openly about what I thought was good and what wasn't good. I didn't realise I was actually being interviewed. I thought I was just being asked about my opinions. It was only afterwards I realised that it was an informal interview, and that they really liked some of the stuff I suggested. And they said, look, get involved. Started making coffee and, like I said, answering phones and things. But what started as a hobby began to progress. I got a lucky break when somebody had to rush off to India. I was then asked to do the video reviews of new Bollywood films. So I was being paid for that, would you believe? I started to do that, and then I started to co-present, and then I had my own show, and I started to present that. And really, I just started to do what I really loved. So I had two careers in parallel. I was working during the daytime as an engineer, designing control systems for power stations, and then I'd have this kind of sudden change, like sort of Superman, you know, put on my costume, and I'd be presenting a program in the evenings. It was really good, because I mean I was loving it. I mean, I had a professional career, and at the same time I was doing something I really enjoyed. But what started as a hobby for me became a career. It was actually progressing to the point where I was doing so much work. And for the first time and the only time in my life, I let my heart do the talking, not my head. And I sort of made this transition from, you know, being a professional engineer into broadcasting. And my family always said, you know, are you sure this is what you want to do? Because you're giving up a stable, you know, career to go to something. And I didn't even have a contract in those days. I just had freelance work, and that was it. But I really wanted to do it. And to be honest, touch wood, I've not looked back or regretted it. I've really enjoyed what I've done. And, you know, I've had some fantastic experiences. I've done, you know, I'm now one of the most experienced Asian broadcasters, because I've been doing it for such a long. I've been broadcasting for 18 years now, and I've been very lucky. I've had some wonderful experiences, met some great people, and I've not looked back.
I want to backtrack just a little bit. I want to ask you about you, because you've told me about your life and growing up here, and it seems like it was quite easy for you, because you went into school and you were immediately in this whole community,
yeah,
and you're pushed right into it. I want to ask you about your mother. How was it for her settling here? You know, having to, you know, work, and her son has to go out to work.
Sure,
and she
sure.
had, it seems like she had some friends, her school friend.
Yeah.
But how was it for her then to establish herself and make, you know, a social life for herself, or, you know, things like that?
Well, I think it was amazing what she has done. It's really difficult to put into words, because the sacrifice and the contribution she's made in her life has really kind of given us the platform on which we, as in all four brothers, have developed a very successful careers. I remember one of my earliest memories of my mum in this country is when I'd wake up in the middle of the night and she'd be there on the sewing machine. And I'm not kidding, I'm not exaggerating. She'd be at 4 o'clock in the morning, she'd be sitting there on the sewing machine. She'd then get us ready to go to school in the mornings, and she'd be on the sewing machine as soon as we leave. If I came back home for lunch, or if I came back home early, or I came back home at normal time, she'd be sitting on the sewing machine. She'd then sort of feed us and back on the sewing machine. Her life revolved around the sewing machine. But it's really ironical, because when she was in Africa, she was a housewife. And in most Asian women didn't work in Africa. It wasn't the cultural thing to do. And it was one person working was kind of normally quite okay enough for a family to be able to survive. But my dad said to her, go and learn sewing. And my mom said, look, why do I want to learn sewing? I'm never going to use it in my life. Why should I? My dad said, you never know. One day you might need it. How true those words were, because he was killed in a car crash. My mom and my brother, I suppose, together had to kind of look after the whole family. So my mum kind of then used the one skill that she knew, which was sewing. So she then, because you see, in those days, you didn't have Asian shops which sold Asian blouses and saris and stuff like that. So you'd have kind of people working from home who'd do these things. So people would come to my mum and she'd make blouses and stuff, and that's how she kind of did. So effectively, her life in bringing us up was done around that sewing machine. Mm-hmm. And for us, that was our livelihood. That's what kind of brought us through a very difficult period. And you say social life. Well, I don't think she had a social life. The only thing she did was occasionally she'd go to the temple when there was a guru or a swami coming from India. She would go and spend time in the evening in the temple, and she made friends there and stuff, and local friends and stuff. But really, she had very little time for social life. And I think this is a very kind of Asian thing, maybe a very Hindu thing, is the devotion that they show, parents show to their children, in that she was willing, even at the age of 30, 35, to forgo everything just for the sake of her children. And I think, I look back now and think, that woman was a superwoman. You know, the stuff and the sacrifice that she made for us, only now I can appreciate. I was too young to appreciate it in those days. You know, in the middle of the night when I woke up and I saw on the sewing machine, I thought that was quite normal. Mm-hmm. And I'd go back to sleep. And now I kind of think, my God, what that woman has done for us to put us where we are, you know, you can never forget. So it was, you know, now I look back and I think it's made us stronger, mm-hmm. because we appreciate certain things. We weren't born with things there on a plate for us. You know, we as a family had to kind of work together in some ways kind of to put that there. And in particular, my mum and my brother. And what I see them and the sacrifices they made now has made me a stronger person. And those are the values I now try and instill in my children.
Okay. I want to move on and ask you just a little bit of a few questions just about your own personal religious practices. First of all, just about your family's religious practices. Do you come from like a... Do you have like a tradition of worship or a traditional murti that you worship, or is, you know, like there is something that's passed down from family to family? Do you have?
Yes,
like
we
that
do actually.
Family?
Ironically enough, because my family have always been very strong believers of Ambama Mataji. That's kind of, you know, the center of our kind of devotional practice. And there's an interesting story that kind of where this all started from, because my granddad was a school teacher in the village Nar, which is where my dad was born before he emigrated. And he had a dream in the night that buried in a place was a stone, and that stone was the embodiment of Mataji, and that really should be turned into the murti. which would then be placed in, as the place for local worship in the village. And my dad, my granddad had a friend who the next morning he met. And funnily enough, they both had exactly the same dream. And this is really kind of sends a chill down my spine when I think about this story, because it's been related, it's been, you know, sort of passed down the family. And they both had the dream, and they dug in that place, and there was a stone, which they uncovered. Today, that stone is still there. It's a murti,
mm-hmm.
which has been turned into the place for worship in the village. And a few years ago, I went to India on holiday, and I wanted to see this place. And I suppose it's how you believe these things. But it was a really moving experience for me, because it was this same stone that my granddad and his friend had dreamt about, and they turned it, and it's now the local form, you know, the local centre of worship in that village. And on the floor there are footprints, or what looks like footprints. It's a marble floor, and local people there believe that Mataji actually came and performed a dance, during Navratri. She did the Ras Garba there. And those are the footprints. And it's what you believe.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are sceptical, some people aren't. But it's what you believe, I suppose. But I've actually taken a video of that myself. And they look like footprints. It's incredible. It's really quite amazing. And it's interesting because after I went to that place, I was involved in an accident. We were in a rickshaw which turned over. Now, you could say one thing or the other, but I feel that there was a bus which was behind us, which literally overtook us fraction of a second before we had this accident. I feel that if we'd had this accident before the bus overtook us, we would have been in a right mess. The bus overtook us and we had the accident. And I feel there was some divine intervention there. It's what you believe at the end of the day, but I believe that there was some divine intervention. And I'd just gone to this place where this little temple, you know, in the village and stuff. And it was quite a moving experience. And so for us, devotion to Mataji has always been there. I say always, actually, that's not quite true. Because I must admit that our faith was shaken somewhat when my dad was killed. We were extremely devoted to Mataji, you know, we've always been a very religious family. And I remember as a child, when my dad was involved in the car accident, that one of our neighbours, whose father was also in the same car, had come running over and said, there's been an accident. My mum had gone to the hospital. We didn't know at this stage that my dad had been killed outright. But I remember the four of us sat there praying for dad, and my mum had gone to the hospital. And as a 10-year-old, I remember looking up to this photograph of Mataji, and I said, please, you know, make my dad all right. And he wasn't all right, he died. So it shook my faith, I'll be honest with you, and I think the whole family felt that way. So we went through this period of several years where, not several years, maybe about 3 or 4 years, where we kind of felt we were let down by our faith, by God. But when we arrived in this country and we started to actually better ourselves, we started, you know, we all settled down. My mum, you know, started to do her work. My brother was then working. We all started to do well in education. We realised that maybe there is somebody supporting us there. So even through difficult times, you kind of feel, yeah, maybe she was there for us all the time. And that restored our faith. And now we sort of, you know, kind of continue with our faith in the same way.
And how do you do any rituals on a daily basis or anything? Or, you know, like a routine that you follow
of
worship?
My interpretation of Hinduism is very different to my mum.
Mm-hmm.
Hers is very traditional. She has a fantastic little mandir in her. One of her rooms is converted to a temple, and it's beautiful, beautiful marble murtis of all the different deities. And her form of worship is very traditional. Whereas my form of practicing my religion, I believe, is in how I live my life on a day-to-day basis. I interpret Hinduism as a way of life, not as necessarily as a religion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's how I interact with people, how I treat people, the purity of thought, and being honest with people. I think that to me is a better way of practicing the religion,
mm-hmm.
than necessarily having a ritual where you sit in front of a photograph or something. But I do that. In the mornings I say a prayer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't sit, you know, like many people, I don't sit there for an hour or 2 hours. But I do every morning stand in front of the little temple that I've got, little mandir. the shrine that I've got in my house, and I'll say a prayer. And I say a prayer for my family, for myself, and that I continue to live my life in the right way. And then in the evenings, I do the same. And I kind of get my little ones. I've got two children, one's 7, one's 3. And I try and get them to stand there and put their hands together and say a prayer. Whether it's, you know, during the Iran earthquake, to say a prayer for people in Iran, or whether it's the war in Iraq, whatever it is, you know, just to kind of think of people and say a prayer. But really, for me, it's more about how you live your life on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, I kind of feel it's hypocritical to stand in front of a little shrine and say a prayer and then go out and do evil things. And I think it's kind of not the way religion should be practiced.
Do you believe in things like, you know, karma or reincarnation?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I think you know, we're all here for a reason. I think there, you know, certainly in my mind, there's no doubt that there is a superior being somewhere. You know, whether you call it Brahma, whether you call it the eternal soul, whether you call it Allah, or whether you call it Krishna, or whether you call it Jesus, it doesn't matter. They're just names for a supreme being, and I which is why I have respect for all religions. I was actually brought up to respect all religions, because at the end of the day, the message of every religion is the same. It's just the way people choose to interpret and practice these things. But yes, I believe that you know, there is this kind of eternal being, and it's the ultimate for every soul is to unite with that soul. It's the analogy I use is that in the same way that raindrops work their way through a river and a stream into the sea, you know, the sea being the eternal being, if you like, you know, is how everything needs to unite. It's, we're a fragment, our souls are fragments of that superior soul, that kind of ultimate being, and eventually, you know, every soul needs to unite with that soul. And I think, and I believe in the traditional Hindu way of doing that is to live your life in a good way, do good things, and kind of use your good deeds as a stepping stone towards kind of that journey, if you like, towards being united with the eternal soul.
Okay. Do you think that your beliefs have developed then over the years of your life?
Yes, I have, and I think living in England has helped me do that. I think if I was living in a very Hindu country like India, I may not have questioned a lot of things, and I think my faith would have been more blind. I would have certainly accepted things and preached and practiced things in a blind faith sort of way of the world. But living in a Western world, you start, you know, because there are contradictions of cultures and contradictions of values and clashes of culture. So you kind of question things. And I think we went, because at college, you know, we as in a group of friends, you know, we all went through this period where we started to question everything. What is life? What are we here for? You know, what is this soul, and what is yoga, and what is all that sort of. And I think because we started to question these things, I then looked at a lot of issues. And I had discussions, if you like, or disagreements with my mum about certain things, certain practices in Hinduism. Because I think, you know, for people to kind of believe that there is a woman with 10 hands or 12 hands, and that's what we believe in, is kind of very simplistic. You know, I think they're symbolisms. They're just to kind of, if you like, explain to people who don't necessarily have the same intellectual ability to say, well, actually what we're trying to say is that there's a superior being. It's not, we're not saying there's a woman with 10 hands or 12 hands. What we're saying is there is that kind of superior being. And I think it's those interpretations in Hinduism which I sometimes find frustrating, because often I think it's preached and practiced in a very simplistic sort of way. And I think Hinduism has so much to offer. It's such a advanced and phenomenally kind of complicated religion. You know, you talk about the cosmos and you talk about all the different energies. You know, for me to accept the three deities, Vishnu, Brahma and Shiva, as three kind of, you know, forms, one is the giver of life, one's the destroyer of life, and one is the observer of life, is not enough. And I, with my scientific background, wanted to kind of interpret that in a very scientific sort of way. You know, what are we talking about here? We're talking about energies, we're talking about, you know, if you like, the cosmos. And for me, it was taking Hinduism to that level, which helped explain it to me better. I started to understand it, if you like, in my language, because I had a very scientific background. I wanted to understand it in those terms, in that context. And because I have interpreted in my way in that context, I feel very happy with the way I now follow the religion, because I kind of feel, yes, it makes sense to me now, you know.
You're happy with it.
Yeah, I'm happy with that, that's right. Most people wouldn't agree with my interpretation. You know, they feel maybe the way they're practicing. Like I say, it's not a criticism of anyone. It's really how people interpret themselves and how they feel happy with what they want to do and I suppose follow their practices.
I just want to ask you a few final questions, just on your opinions on various issues that arise. I want to ask you, do you think the youth of today, do you feel that they are more or less religious than, say, when you were a youth?
I think there's a mixed bag. I mean, I know some young people who are extremely devout, follow the religion in a very dedicated way. I don't think that applies across the board. I think when I was younger, there was more general acceptance of religion and people practiced the religion, okay, in the way it was practiced. So they kind of follow traditional norms. I think now young people tend to question things a bit more and they don't necessarily accept things for face value. They'll say, but why? Why does that happen? And they feel happy with that. I think that's good. I think we should question everything. There's nothing which is sacred, not even religion. Let's question these things because that'll help our understanding. And the young people these days do tend to do that. And so those people who question and then kind of have an understanding, I think their practice is more solid because they really understand what they're doing. It's not just this question of, oh God, I'm being forced into doing this. I'll sit down and do it. And then I'll go and play football because that's really what I want to do. You know, it's not that kind of way of doing it. But then again, I think we live in a different society, which is not necessarily conducive to practicing religions, which are, if you like, very Eastern. You know, I think we live in the Western world, and certain practices do, you know, become difficult to practice because of lots of external pressures. You know, there's the media and there's the culture is very kind of, you know, free, I think, and that sort of thing. So it does become difficult. So I think by and large, it's not necessarily practiced in the same way it was when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But those people that do overcome these kind of, if you like, barriers and question things, I think the way they practice their religion, I think is very commendable because they really questioned everything and started to interpret things before they accept it.
Okay. Do you think it's important then for them to learn their mother tongue as well?
I don't think it's vital,
mm-hmm.
but I think because you see Hinduism, unlike lots of other religions, is a very interpretative religion, if there is such a word. In other words, what I'm saying is, it's not something that you can write down in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
It's there's lots of interpretations. And so really, it's difficult to read and learn everything through reading scriptures and things. That you really have to be told these things from people who know, gurus, parents, religious leaders, that sort of thing. So if you have an understanding of Asian languages, whether it's your mother tongue or whether it's Sanskrit or whatever, will make you understand certain things. Because, for example, my mother, if she was trying to explain something to me, because she doesn't speak that good English, she won't be able to explain it in the language I'd understand.
Mm-hmm.
So she may not be able to explain something to me because if I didn't really understand my mother tongue that well. So it's important for her to explain. If I question something, for example, in Hinduism, she will then try and explain it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because she doesn't speak English that well, and if I didn't speak my mother tongue that well, then there would be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
There would be that sort of barrier. So I think if having a sort of some sort of basic understanding of the mother tongue will help, you know, because I think, you know, sometimes it's difficult just to interpret what a religion is all about just through books. And especially when I was a student, I used to read a lot of, I even read the Bhagavad Gita in English.
Mm-hmm.
And I read other books in English. But that didn't really sort of tell me everything I needed to know because it would start me off, that would be my starting point. But then it sort of had a lot of questions in me.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave birth to a lot of questions which weren't being answered. And the only way they were going to be answered was by speaking to people and saying, well, this is what it says, but, you know, what does it mean, or
yeah.
why, you know? And so I think it's important to have understanding, basic understanding of the mother tongue, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Complete different thing now. Do you think that caste issues are still prevalent today, both here and, say, in India
yes.
or Africa, or wherever there's community, you know, Asian communities
yes.
or Hindu communities?
They are. They are. I think people still generally, because our parents still have influence, would prefer kind of, you know, for us to follow those traditions. But in England, people are questioning these things a bit more. And it's really how you, as an individual, interpret the caste system. You know, my interpretation is that it's division of labour. It's what, you know, happens in every society. You know, for any community to function, you have to have people who've got expertise in certain areas. And so you have a carpenter, and you have a trader, and you have a soldier, and you have a farmer, and they contribute to society. It doesn't mean that the farmer is better than the cleaner, or the Brahmin is better than the farmer. I think that's where I think the whole concept of caste system's been misinterpreted. If we take the premise that everybody's equal, we're all human beings and we're all equal, but we have different expertise,
mm-hmm.
then I think that's a good starting point. What I disagree with in terms of the caste system is where people kind of have this feeling of superiority. And I'm a Brahmin, and I feel very critical of it, because I'm supposed to be the top of the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
That's wrong. We're all equal. That's the way I look at it. However, in this country, when you're surrounded by other cultures and other religions which don't have this caste system, so you have friends who are Muslim, or you have friends who are Christian, and you see that they don't have this class, caste structure, then people say, well, why should we need it? And I think that's being eroded now. Also, now people kind of meet, whether it's at university or in the working environment, they meet somebody who may also maybe a Hindu, but not of the same caste, but they fall in love. And you say, well, hang on, you know, we're in love, we want to get married. You know, the caste system doesn't apply to us, or we're not interested in that.
Okay, yeah, so the caste.
Yeah.
So, just two final questions then.
Mm-hmm.
how would you identify yourself now? You know, your family of deep Indian roots, but you were born in Africa with that there, but you, most of your life has been spent in the UK,
yes.
And you're also a Hindu. How do you identify yourself?
That's really difficult. I always, I'm British, first and foremost. And I'm very proud to be British. I mean, this is my home now. I'm very proud of my roots. I've got Indian roots, and I practice Hinduism. I'm very proud of those roots, because that's really made me the character that I am, and given me some sort of identity. But first and foremost, I live in this country. This is my home now, and I contribute to British society. And Britain has given me a lot, so I see myself first and foremost as British. But I'm also very proud of my Asian roots, and a British Indian. I see myself as a British Indian because I'm very proud of my roots, you know, my Indian roots, and I'm very, very proud of the way my parents brought me up, and so I feel very proud to be associated with that tag, Indian, because that really kind of has given me the foundations on which everything I've done, or everything I believe, or everything I've practiced has been built on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you like, that's my kind of core structure, is being of Indian origin, and everything, all my thought processes are built on that. But now I've British or sort of westernized all those things,
mm-hmm.
and adapted them to my life in this country, because I feel that way I'll be a kind of a good citizen of this. I know this sounds really worthy, doesn't it? But it means I'm very kind of, you know, a very kind of strong member of the community here, because this is the community I'm contributing to at the end of the day, because I am British,
mm-hmm.
you know.
My second question was going to be, where do you see us home now? But you've already...
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because
yeah.
I always saw, ultimately I thought, I used to think, and especially during my days in the 70s when I used to face a lot of racism here, when I first arrived here, this was home. Britain was the home, this is where we were going to settle. But I'll be honest with you, I didn't feel we were made that welcome.
Mm-hmm.
During that phase, I didn't feel I was made that welcome. What I accepted as home, and this being my home, other people didn't see that in me. I wasn't made to feel that those people saw me as somebody whose home was in Britain. So that was a difficult period. And then I began to feel, well, yeah, okay, but I live here, but my home is still India.
Mm-hmm.
Until several years later when I actually went to India. I found it extremely difficult. I love the place. Beautiful place, great people, a lot of history there. The cultural heritage is just something extraordinary. But I just couldn't settle in that country. I couldn't feel that I could live in... I mean, for a holiday to see my family and everything would be great, but I couldn't live in India. It's the most frustrating place I could ever visit. but I'd love it. So for me, it opened my eyes about what my home really was. And I was then saying to people that I can't wait to get back home. And home then was Britain. And I realized then that actually Britain is my home. Britain's given me so much, you know, and it's still giving me so much, and it's going to give a lot to my children. My children are born here. For them, this is, they know nothing else. So I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't say this is my home. So for me, Britain is now my home, even though I still have a kind of very strong pull from India and stuff.
Have you ever been back to Africa?
I have never been back to Africa. Isn't that funny? And I would love to go back to Africa. But I just, the circumstances really kind of, you know, meant I've never been back. But I'd love to go and to see the school where I kind of went to, and the area where I was brought up and stuff. And maybe I'll do that pilgrimage one day.
Okay. And finally then, do you have any final message to give to people who will be listening to this in the future?
I think the way, what I've always said to my kids and to people I've spoken to when we've discussed religion is to kind of question aspects of Hinduism, because that's the way you will get better knowledge. Because Hinduism is a phenomenal religion. It has so much to offer. And it's not just about God, it's about how you live your life, about your daily practices, as well as how you interact with people, and also, of course, how you kind of, you know, if you want to question, and everybody, whether you're religious or not, questions, what are we doing here? What is the purpose of life? Well, I think Hinduism gives a lot of answers. What I would say is delve in deep, really question things and try and really understand. And I wouldn't even begin to suggest that I'm understanding these things. I think I'm beginning to question things and I'm formulating little ideas in my mind. But the religion and the knowledge within that religion is so vast that I think it would take several lifetimes to really understand. But I think if you can question these things and begin to discover a lot of the sort of things that Hinduism is beginning to kind of tell us about, I think that would be the best way to kind of the way to kind of understand a lot of questions about life.
Thank you very much.
I've really gone on and
it's
gone
okay.
on these, but then I work in radio, you see, and
it's fine.
Is that all right?